Because the real question is whether the scapegoat foundation of culture is really true or not. And this is a purely biblical and Christian affair. So in the case of Buddhism, you have the same view of victimization and so forth. And you have also in Christianity the idea that the victimizers, to a certain extent, are not guilty. Because you have it especially in Luke. You have it in Luke, you know, and I read in one of my books the phrase of Jesus, "O Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do." You know, I said this is a definition of the unconscious of the persecutors. So some people laughed and said, oh, you know, he's really ingenious. But that's too much. You see what I mean? But if you go to the beginning of Acts, which is by Luke, too, or so we think, and this is one of the reasons to think so, we have Peter addressing the crowd of Jerusalem and saying, you don't realize what you've been doing. You've been killing the Lord of glory. But you were ignorant, and even your leaders were ignorant. In other words, however cynical Pilate, Herod, and all these guys could be, they were ignorant of the main thing. Therefore, the scapegoat process is unconscious. We do not know that we are persecutors. That's the main thing which Christianity tells you. And that is the reason, in my view, why the first two Christians, the experience of scapegoating, you know, is one which no one has. You cannot write a phenomenology of scapegoating. Phenomenology is when you bring back everything to the experience of the subject, the deepest experience of the subject. Who has ever experienced scapegoating? Absolutely nobody. Asked the whole population of the United States or France, you know, have a poll and say, is there scapegoating around you in the professions, in law, in business, as well as politics? 100%, yes. Ask exactly the same people, are you a scapegoater? 100% no. Everybody around me is a scapegoater. That's why the denunciation of scapegoating can become, and does become, that's absolutely essential to our society, that the denunciation of scapegoating has become the main scapegoat accusation. You cannot accuse anyone without accusing them of being persecutors. That's why people like Nietzsche were right in being in a way nauseated with Christianity. But he saw the caricature and he did not see the original. Because the question is whether it's true. You see, and I think the symbolism of Christianity is just so unbelievably powerful in respect to that. So how can we see about scapegoating? The Gospels never tell you that the disciples were more intelligent, more lucid, you know, or that they realized Jesus was innocent because they had seniority in the Christian business. They all succumbed to scapegoating. Because when Peter denies his master, he is the model archetype of all mankind. It's not a personal indictment of him. That's the way men are. Therefore, the experience of scapegoating, there is only one type of people who experiences it. It's the experience of conversion. Christian conversion is nothing else. That's why Peter really converts when he understands he has denied his master. As for Paul, it's so obvious. The question of Christ to Paul is, why do you persecute me? You see what I mean? And to become a Christian is to discover that one is a persecutor. And this, I think, is the absolute radicalism. The fact that most Christians have not understood that historically must not be turned into an accusation of Christians and Christianity. Because just as in Buddhism, sacrificial phenomena of the worst kind reappear all over the place, including Tibet, Sri Lanka, and so forth, as they may. Nevertheless, they are much lessened in relation to the past. And the question is not measuring people and the sociological influence that one religion may have had and another. It's to question the texts. And the thing which is so powerful about Christianity is the definition of the main words. We think that Satan is ridiculous. You know, there's not one theologian in the world today that dares mention Satan for fear of being ridiculous. But if you look at the opposition in comparison of Satan and the Holy Spirit, you understand everything. The original meaning of Satan is the accuser. He's the accuser that enforces the accusation, that makes Oedipus seem guilty. Now, the meaning of the Holy Spirit, the Paraclete, seems so strange to Jerome when he translated the Bible that he didn't dare translate it. He invented a Latin word, Paracletus. And so we have in English Paraclete, in French Paraclet, and so forth. Why no translation? It's the simplest word to translate, and some Bibles translate it. The Paraclete is the lawyer for the defense. Satan is the prosecutor, as in Job, and he convinces everybody of guilt, and that's myth, and the Paraclete is the lawyer for the defense. In other words, if the disciples turn around and become that small group of dissidents that say it's not true, it's not because of their intelligence or anything, it's because the Paraclete is there. That's what they say. They don't brag about anything. They say it's a Paraclete who is speaking through us, insofar as we denounce this persecution. Because I think there are two types of totalitarianism in our world. You know, they are both essentially connected to Christianity. The first type, which in a way is the most honest, is neo-paganism, which is after Nietzsche. We don't want any of this business. You know, this is sickness. A society has to be able to sacrifice. Nietzsche, the last Nietzsche, says that very explicitly. It's been expurgated. No one talks about it because it's too close to Nazism. And everybody says Nietzsche has nothing to do with Nazism, but I think Nietzsche is the real philosopher of Nazism in the highest sense. This totalitarianism says we are going to kill so many victims that we will prove to you that the significance of our culture is not the end of victimage. And we are going to reinstate paganism. In my view, all forms of neo-paganism, very innocently at times, do the same thing and want to cancel that out. The other form of totalitarianism, which is in the ascendancy, because the first one is gone, is overdoing it. You have to remember that communism, all forms of totalitarianism of the left, are the failure of Christianity to abolish, and all religion, to abolish scapegoating, and we have the better way to do it, because we know it's a social phenomenon, because we know it's a psychological phenomenon, as the psychoanalysts will tell you, because we know it has something to do with race. You know, and there are certain races that don't scapegoat and others that do, and so forth. You see what I mean? So, in a way, it's the super-Christianity that communism tried to be. And I think we are going to see other forms of it, which might be infinitely worse than what we have seen in the past. But today we are, I think, living the failure of these attempts at replacing, doing away with Christianity, or turning it into some form of ideology by appropriating it in a certain way and exaggerating it in all forms. We are all aware of the failure of many people to make the efforts that they should. But at the same time, our society, I think, would have perished long ago if there were not a tremendous amount of implicit understanding of what we're talking about and of acting upon it. You see what I mean? In the sense that our society is still going on and expanding every day. And however badly and so forth, opening up all the time. You see, opening up in ways which create new problems and so forth. But I think, to go back to your idea, I don't think I'm an optimist, but I think that the type of world in which we live, we don't realize enough how fantastic it is. You see what I mean? We talk about disenchantment of modern world and so forth, but at the same time, we don't realize that there has been cultural relativism is true in relative ways, but in a certain way, our society is absolutely unique. It has a form of universalism and a form, even the people who do not appreciate its opening and want to close up and so forth, always do it in full awareness of what they are doing, which no society in the past did, and in full awareness of the arguments against, and in full awareness of what they say is rejected by many other people. And very often they do not quite believe what they say. But to say how much, I think is impossible. Yes? Well, there are two ways to be original. You know, I criticized earlier the modern conception of originality. We're going to say, we're going to do, we're going to think something entirely different from other people. I think only a hyper-mimetic world, obsessed with not imitating, can come to such a point. Therefore, indirectly, in my view, this concept, the modern concept of originality, which was born with Romanticism, in a way testifies to the mimetic nature of our world. Imitation, mimesis, and so forth is the bad word par excellence in our world, in culture. If you bring it in, it's like doing something disgraceful, not being polite. You see what I mean? Only originality. So there is another notion of originality, which I think is more profound, and which is not really mine, which is going back to the origin and changing it. What Christ is doing is going back to the bad origin, which is violent, and making it not non-violent by suffering the violence willingly instead of inflicting it. So this origin will not immediately change everything, but will slowly act like that transformation I was talking about, and changing our world in a gradual fashion, which is, I think, what is happening today, faster and faster. I don't know if I'm answering your question. Yeah, well, today, if you take the greatest violators of human rights, you know, they always speak the language of the opposite of what they're doing, which the Romans would not have done. If you had gone to a Roman Pontius Pilate, you know, or any Roman functionary, and told him, I've been victimized, therefore I have rights, he would open big eyes and would say, are you a Roman citizen? You see what I mean? But he would not even understand, he would not even laugh. He would not understand at all what you're talking about. So we live in a world, in a way, where today even the powers have learned that you must speak the language of victims. You see? And very often you speak it half sincerely. What is hypocrisy? Hypocrisy is not the same thing as lying. There is the truth, and there is a lie on the other side, and maybe there is hypocrisy in the middle, when you believe your own lie. And I think most people believe their own lies. Most people are sincere. You know, sincerity is the cheapest good in the world. Only our enemies are insincere. But we all are always sincere at all times and have never been insincere, really. You see what I mean? So it's the same thing, again, as the unconsciousness of scapegoating. It's always a question of turning back against oneself. We are also the world of self-examination, you You see what I mean? We are often criticized for that. We are presented precisely the idea of Nietzsche that our culture is sick. It's because of self-examination. And being the son of a Protestant minister, he saw Protestantism as the arch perversion of that, Christians, the most perverse form of that Christian sickness, which is constantly asking oneself if I'm doing the right thing. And undoubtedly, there are aspects which may become neurotic and so forth. But fundamentally, it's the greatest thing in the world. And today, no one dares defend it. It can be corrupted in a certain way, but a society in which people are able to ask this question is infinitely better than any other in the past. You see? And today, we come to the point where we do not dare say this anymore. That regardless of how bad the perversions of that principle are, it is the greatest principle in the world. And there is no doubt that no form of paganism will instill that into you. Yes? The way I think the New Testament has to be read is closer to Talmudic Midrashic interpretation than anything else. You know, because in order to see this, you have to give some examples of it, you know. And I don't know it as well as I do. But I remember one thing which enlightened me greatly about the sacrifice of Abraham, you know. Sacrifice of Abraham is a non-sacrifice of Abraham. In Jewish terms, the binding of Abraham, the Akedah. You know, and finally, Abraham, you know, finds the ram, which is caught by its horns in the thicket, and sacrifices the ram. Now, there is some Midrashic Talmudic comment on that. Oh no, I'm afraid I'm wrong. But it doesn't matter, because it's the same style, and that shows I can be ecumenical. What I'm saying is in the Quran. It's in the Quran, but Mahomet, you know, in a way was a Talmudic interpreter. You know, in the Quran, there are these words which are very strange, which says the ram which was sent by God to Abraham is the animal that Abel had sacrificed. Abel was a sacrificer of animals, whereas his brother Cain did not sacrifice blood. So, you know, you see this and you say, how mad this is. But if you think in terms of sacrifice, you understand very well. Abel does not sacrifice his brother because he sacrifices animals. They are a substitute for man. And this is the same thing in the case of Abraham. Cain may be one of these people who think you can do away with sacrifice immediately, you know, without going through the historical stages. And therefore he ends up killing his Therefore, the idea that the animal is the same means the animal has the same function in both instances. But this is very much in the style of certain Jewish comments, you know. For instance, that's another example that had impressed me. I see mimetic rivalry is present behind all discourse on sacrifice, all the great scenes of sacrifice, you know. And still, the question of Abraham. There is a Jewish comment saying that while Abraham and his son were climbing Mount Moriah, supposedly to have Isaac sacrificed, the two servants who were there, who were the favorites of Abraham, were fighting each other, being mimetic rivals, about who would become the inheritor, the missing son. You see what I mean? So, this comment puts mimetic rivalry there, which doesn't seem to be there. And that I find absolutely marvelous. You see what I mean? The sense that it has to be there, because that's what sacrifice is about. But of course, you have to go through, it's never theoretical. It's just, so I would say we have to understand these things better, because usually they have a profound meaning in terms of human relations. And this is what the philosophical Christianity of the Middle Ages or today they don't understand that these things are always meaningful in terms of human relations, which means ultimately in terms of love or hate, which brings you to prayer.
Exactly. The space in which the knowledge disappears.
It's less important to interpret the text than ultimately to love your brother. But if you love your brother and if you enjoy reading text at the same time, which is not very important, but and so forth, you probably have more of a chance to give ultimately the right interpretation, the charitable interpretation, as the Christian would say, than if you hate your brother. Because if you hate your brother, you have something in your eye, some scandal, some obstacle, which prevents you from seeing the truth, which is John, which is very Talmudic too, in many ways. Well, I don't really think it has a revelation in a Christian sense. I think it's a different historical stage. You see what I mean? I don't know it enough to pass judgment, you know, and one should be sure to avoid judgment. But I think that the Christian revelation, in the sense of the Passion, in a sense, is once and for all. Is there, you know. And I'm sure that in the Quran there are aspects of it which are taken into account. And that's all I could say. You know, I wrote my first book on mimetic desire, mimetic rivalry, which is, I'm a literary critic, fundamentally. I was trained as a historian, but I started to teach literature in this country and I didn't know what to do. And I looked for what made the great novels similar to each other rather than different. You know, according to literary criticism, 40 years ago, the important thing was originality in the sense that I don't like. Trying to show that each book says something entirely different from all the others, says it in a different way. You know, the aesthetic viewpoint that I cannot stand. And instead of doing that, which you had to do then, which you still have to do today, but you look for different things. I was interested in the psychology, what people would call the psychology of these novels, and I felt that it was the same always, that it had what I call that mimetic rivalry, that there were always people, lovers, for instance, choosing the same lover, not because of the object, but because jealousy came before love, in a way. Or envy. That's what I call mimetic desire. You imitate your model, but if you both imitate each other, you will desire the same object. Philosophy has not seen that. Philosophy, especially with Plato, has talked magnificently about imitation, but has excluded imitation from and desire, has separated the two. You see, and I think that the great tragedies, the great novels, the great literature always put the two together. If my last book was on Shakespeare, because I think Shakespeare is the greatest, that the greatness of Shakespeare is due or can be defined at least up to a point, because you cannot define the greatness of Shakespeare, of course. The fact that he sees this, you know, friendship and hatred are one and the same, Shakespeare. The two friends who, in a flash, becomes the worst of enemies. Because suddenly, as always, they desire the same thing. And most of the time, to be two friends is to desire the same thing. The same books, the same pieces of music. To love the same thing. But suddenly you love the same woman. And it doesn't work the same way. You know, and no one warns children that this is going to happen. Because we live in an enlightenment world where we are supposed not to see these things, to deny that they exist, to say that man is good. And that man won't get in trouble unless the bad capitalist or the bad communist make them bad. No. If men desire the same thing because they imitate each other, there is a principle of conflict in human affairs that we cannot dispose with scapegoating. We cannot say it's some bad people who are responsible for that. We all do it. And if you speak of that to adolescents today, who have never been as unprotected as today, because today the voices of cultures tell them constantly the opposite of the truth. Be yourself, be all, be do what you want, satisfy all your desires, you'll never get into trouble. The next minute, their best friend becomes their worst enemy. This is totally Shakespearean. So they understand. But we, the generations that believe in the Enlightenment are protected generations, where the rules were still working enough to protect people from this kind of conflict. So they could afford to be against the rules. You see what I mean? They could afford to be even sacrifice. How could we be? How can we afford to be against sacrifice? What does sacrifice mean? It means if you have a choice between a great deal of violence and very little, you choose the very little. That's a sacrificial violence. So if we think, if you think that I said we can do away with sacrifice, you know, immediately, I don't say that at all. I say only Christ did away with sacrifice. But in order to do away with sacrifice, you have to say, well, I don't want a bigger violence, but I don't want the smallest one either, therefore I prefer to die myself. And if you are able to do that, I congratulate you. But I know that I'm not able to do it. You see what I mean? Therefore, I do not say that I've done away with the sacrificial world. You see, I really think that Jesus gave the recipe for doing away. You know, says, if there is an excessive demand on you, that's what I think the rules, if there is an excessive demand of you, if people slap you, instead of escalating the mimetic rivalry, give up everything and you do away with it. I don't think the rules of the kingdom of God are a form of socialism, you know, or a form of utopia. They are, if they want you to walk a mile with them, walk two. If they want half of your coat, give them. In other words, discourage this sort of inflation of conflict that takes over, you know, when people want the same thing. If they make excessive demands on you, it's that they already are in mimetic rivalry. If you answer the same way, you only escalate. Therefore, in the end, everybody loses. But in order to do that to the end, would be very easy if everybody did it, because nobody would slap anybody in the face. But if no one does it, it means you'll have to die. The good news becomes bad news for the one who says, hey guys, this is what I propose to you. We all give up this rivalry. But it's not a 50-50 proposition, because the 50-50 proposition is what men have always had. And men always feel that it's been violated by the other fellow. Therefore, I take it quite seriously. And whatever you do, I will go on respecting it. You can be sure you'll end up sacrificed that way. I think this is the logic behind the passion. I simplify it, I schematize it. You see, I prefer to die than to take part in that rat race. Therefore, I reveal it as it really is, which we never mention, you know. So, capital punishment. Capital punishment, of course, is a perfect bone of contention, you know. We are very generous, we are against it, and so forth. I'm against it. And I think we live in a world where it proves how dysfunctional it is. But to be, in order to be really against it, you have to say, I'm ready to die, instead of the victim. Father Kolbe in the concentration camp, who took the place of a victim. To be very self-righteously against capital punishment in a world where there's an enormous amount of crime and so forth, is very easy and very simple. We can be, and I'm against capital punishment, but I cannot indict the people who are for. That's what I mean. You can be against without turning it into a bone of contention and say, oh, these bad people. You see what I mean? Because it's another form of scapegoating.